Chapter 23, Changes at the Vihara. By mid-November, I had been incumbent of the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara for well over a year, and during that time my work had increased to such an extent that it was hardly possible for me to do more than I was already doing. Indeed, I needed to do less. During the summer months, I had suffered on and off from an extremely painful gum boil, with me always a sign of physical strain, which I took to be a warning that I was doing too much work on too little nourishment, for I was still following the rule of taking no solid food after midday, and did not always eat properly even before then. Besides all my regular lectures and classes at the Vihara and at the Buddhist Society, and my lectures at the College of Psychic Science and elsewhere, I had the Buddhist to edit and produce, the provincial groups to visit, correspondence to deal with, visitors to receive, personal interviews to give, and the everlasting telephone to answer. There was also, of course, the Vihara itself to run, with all that this entailed in the way of caring for the shrine and meeting room and making arrangements for such mundane things as shopping, cooking, and cleaning. After returning from the summer school, I therefore started sounding out Morris and Goulstone regarding the possibility of the Trust providing me with full-time paid secretarial help. I already had an agency shorthand typist coming and taking dictation whenever I had an unusually large number of letters to answer, but this ad hoc arrangement, paid for, I think, by the association, was not very satisfactory. The same person was not always available. Sometimes I did not get the finished work back for a week or more. Sometimes it contained mistakes, and sometimes the shorthand typist herself, usually an elderly woman, arrived in so depressed and tearful a state that I was obliged to spend the time listening to her troubles and counselling her instead of giving dictation. Though I explained all this to Morris, and though he was aware of the extent to which my work had increased, his initial reaction when I sounded him out on the subject of full-time paid secretarial help was one of alarm. "The Trust couldn't possibly afford it," he protested. "It simply didn't have the money." Goulstone was more sympathetic. As treasurer of both the Sangha Trust and the Sangha Association, he had a better understanding of the needs of the situation. He knew that Claire Sampson would not be around much longer, and that it would not be easy for the association to find a new honorary secretary, especially one who could help him in the way Claire sometimes did. The upshot was that the trustees agreed, after weeks of discussion, that the Trust could, in fact, afford to meet the expenses of a full-time secretary, that Goulstone and I would share her services, and that it would be up to me to find the right person. I found her with the help of Cathy Phelps, the blonde, voluptuous young Cockney woman who was soon to become General Secretary of the Buddhist Society in succession to staid, elderly Joan Pope, who had occupied the post for longer than most members of the society could remember. She had a friend who was looking for a job with a religious organisation, Cathy told me in the society's office one afternoon over a cup of tea. This friend had spiritual interests, was working on a book on occultism, and might well be just the sort of person I wanted. Could she ask her to come and see me? She certainly could. A few days later, therefore, the friend presented herself at the Vihara. I saw and liked her, as did Goulstone, and 3 weeks later, when November was almost over, despite last-minute objections from Morris, our new full-time secretary started work in the ground-floor front room that Vichitta and his companion, fortunately, had just vacated. Instead of Office of Thai Sangha, the sign on the door now read Reception. Francoise Strachan, brown-haired and simply dressed, was a quietly spoken young woman of average looks and rather more than average intelligence. Within a few weeks, she had created a proper office, probably the first either the Trust or the Association had ever had, and had started relieving me of all kinds of minor but time-consuming tasks. Besides typing articles meant for publication in The Buddhist, she dealt with routine correspondence, received casual visitors, answered the telephone, passed on messages, went to the post office, and bought flowers for the shrine, all of which enabled me not only to devote more time to my own real work, but to have little time to myself. Goulstone found her no less useful than I did. Formerly, he had rarely been seen at the Vihara, usually only when there was a meeting of the Association Committee, or more recently, of the Trust. But now, wearing his black opera coat and smelling of whiskey and cigars, he was to be seen there almost every weekday morning, generally spending at least half an hour closeted with Francoise before going on to his legal practice. Despite his increased interest in the Vihara, he did not start attending lectures and classes, and on Sunday afternoons and weekday evenings I saw no more of him than I had done before Francoise's arrival. That we now had a full-time secretary working in our ground floor front room, with all that this entailed for me in the way of reduced workload, was not the only change to take place at the Vihara that autumn. Our little community saw various comings and goings both before and after the departure of the Thai monks. Most of these were of young men who wanted, or thought they wanted, to become monks, and whom I invited to stay at the Vihara for a while and have at least a tongue-tip taste of monastic life. Only three of them lasted for more than a couple of weeks. One or two did not even manage to pluck up the courage to accept my invitation, and they therefore remain, for the most part, shadowy figures whose names I have long since forgotten. The three exceptions were Victor, who had moved into the Vihara when Ratanasara moved out, the young man who, after coming to the Vihara regularly for some months, had been on retreat with me at Biddulph, and whom I had recently ordained as Vajrabodhi, and the one who lasted longest, Eric, whom I was to ordain as Virya. Eric was a pink-faced, sandy-haired young man of 25 or 26, whose slightly aquiline nose was wrinkled up, more often than not, in an expression of disgust. I do not remember where we first met, but it must have been either at a meeting of the Brighton Buddhist Group or at the Buddhist Society's summer school, probably the latter. Wherever it was, he was soon coming to see me regularly. We had a number of serious discussions, and one early September afternoon, in the course of a particularly good exchange, he asked me to accept him as a probationer. I remember that afternoon very well, though not so much on account of Eric's request itself, which was not entirely unexpected, as because of what followed. Eric had a girlfriend called Elizabeth, whom I had not met, and he had asked her to come to the Vihara 2 hours after his own arrival there, by which time, as he knew, he would have made his request, and he hoped been accepted as a probationer. No sooner had she entered my room and been introduced than he drew a deep breath and told her, with evident emotion, "Liz, I'm going to become a monk." However much she may have been aware of her boyfriend's intentions, this abrupt announcement must have come as a shock to Elizabeth, but she took it well, and Claire having joined us for a cup of tea, we all spent the rest of the afternoon together pleasantly enough. A week later, Eric moved into the Vihara. "A new broom sweeps clean," says the proverb, and as far as the domestic arrangements of the Vihara were concerned, Eric proved to be every inch a new broom. He swept and cleaned the kitchen and dining room, turned out cupboards, threw away junk, burned stacks of old magazines, mowed the lawn at the back of the house, and weeded the overgrown little front garden. Within a month of his arrival, the Vihara was looking neater and tidier than it had done for a long time. So much of a new broom was Eric that eventually he swept out of the Vihara both Victor and Vajrabodhi, whose untidy ways and lack of care for the place caused his nose to wrinkle up in an expression of deeper disgust than usual. Victor, who in any case was not really a probationer, having asked for ordination in a rash moment and then regretted it, had been showing signs of restlessness for some time. After spending 3 weeks in North Africa and a week in his hometown of Nottingham, he moved into Amritapani's community in Camden Town, where his girlfriend was already staying. Subsequently, as a result of his being involved in an incident there, he had to leave the place in a hurry and was not seen for a year or more. As for Vajrabodhi, he left the Vihara in a huff after he and Eric had clashed in the kitchen. His departure may have had something to do with the fact that I had reprimanded him for allowing a 16-year-old girl to come to his room for private lessons in the Dharma, as he most unwisely had been doing. He left without telling anybody, and some weeks later I heard that he and the girl had gone to stay with friends of the Vihara in Gloucestershire, and that the girl was pregnant. Eric's passion for cleanliness and order was not simply of the utilitarian kind, but possessed a decidedly aesthetic dimension. He had a great interest in Japanese art and culture, was learning the Japanese language, preferred chopsticks to a knife and fork, and, when not actually working, wore a blue and white patterned kimono about the house. Before long, he struck up a friendship with Emil Boyne, the proprietor of the Japanese shop in Monmouth Street, and Emil's partially deaf wife, Sarah. And at Eric's suggestion, Emil presented me with a yellow silk kimono. So far as I remember, Eric had no particular interest in Zen, but naturally he was interested in meditation, and therefore was happy to join me in my morning sessions on the cushion. Sometimes we went for a walk on Hampstead Heath before meditating, for, like me, he was an early riser and liked to be up and about before dawn. Sometimes, indeed, we were out so early that it was still dark when we got back, and then Eric would take up his guitar and, in his pleasant, rather nasal tenor voice, sing to his own accompaniment plaintive country and western ballads, as I suppose they must have been, until the clock struck 7 and it was time to meditate. Terry usually joined us for our morning sessions, after which the three of us would have a cup of tea and a chat together, and he would leave for work. The appearance at the Vihara of a full-time paid secretary and the comings and goings of various members of our little community, especially the arrival of Eric on the scene, were important changes, and they made a big difference to me. But there also took place around this time another important change, and one that made, in the long run, an even bigger difference to both me and Terry. On the 19th of November, Terry left his job. Or rather, he told the advertising agency for which he worked that he would be leaving at the end of the year. He also moved earlier that same week from his old quarters in Chalk Farm to a bigger flat nearer the Vihara. Terry's decision to leave his job was not a sudden one. It was a step he had been contemplating for some time, even before meeting me. Though good at his well-paid design work and popular with his colleagues, he nonetheless felt, in the competitive, manipulative world of advertising, out of place to the point of alienation, and indeed had developed for its shallow materialistic values a loathing that at times made him physically ill. During the last few months he had been finding it increasingly difficult to carry on, though he kept up a cheerful front and nobody in his office, not even the faithful Alan, had the least idea how he really felt. From time to time he was the victim of moods of depression, out of which I did not always find it easy to talk him. These moods were not entirely due to the kind of work he was doing. His visits to Ilford also played a part. Every other week he collected Fiona from her mother and took her to his parents' place for the weekend. These weekends under the parental roof were a sore trial to Terry. Besides reminding him of his solitary, unhappy childhood and thus reviving all his old feelings of resentment towards his parents, feelings he was forced to conceal, they tended to confirm his impression that his daughter was being subjected at the hands of her mother and grandmother to influences of the same repressive and deadening kind that had had such a disastrous effect on his own emotional life. As an instance of this, he once told me that by the time she was 3, they had conditioned Fiona into refusing to be undressed or given a bath in front of her father or grandfather. What was an even greater trial to him, his parents had never told their friends and neighbours about the breakdown of his marriage, the whole subject being in their eyes too painful and too shameful to be mentioned. If anyone asked after Gillian, Terry had to say that she was quite well, thank you, as though the two of them were still living together, a piece of pretence that revolted his honest and truth-loving nature. He therefore returned from his visits to Ilford tired and depressed and in need of a good deal of encouragement and reassurance. The flat to which Terry had moved was situated in Lancaster Grove, conveniently equidistant from Belsize Park and Swiss Cottage underground stations, and not far from the Hampstead Public Library. It was bigger than his old flat, only in the sense that it comprised not a single but a double room, one corner of which had been partitioned off to form a kitchen. Terry had moved there not only because his flat in King Henry's Road was small and dark, and not at all the sort of place he wanted to spend his days as well as his nights in once he had stopped working, but also because he was concerned to provide me with a quiet place to which I could retire whenever I needed a brief respite from the busy life of the Vihara. The upstairs, eastward-looking front room at 3 Lancaster Grove was certainly quiet, much quieter than my own room on busy Haverstock Hill. It was quiet partly because Lancaster Grove was a side street, so that hardly any noise penetrated from outside, even when the windows were open, and partly because the various occupants of the other flats in the building, a substantial Victorian property, were out most days of the week, and even when they were in, made little or no sound, and kept out of each other's way. During the 6 or 7 months that Terry and I sometimes lived there, the only people we actually saw, apart from the landlady, were the two women, apparently mother and daughter, who occupied a room on the same floor as us, and whom, to their embarrassment, we occasionally surprised tiptoeing along the passage towards the common bathroom. The landlady herself, who lived in the rather gloomy basement flat, we saw only when Terry paid the rent. Like many landladies, old Mrs. Hartman was a suspicious soul, rightly so if even half the stories Bernie Whiteclaw told me about his tenants were to be believed, and Terry had not won her confidence immediately. On his going to see her about the room, and explaining that he would be sharing it occasionally with a friend who was a Buddhist monk, she had insisted on seeing me before accepting him as a tenant. As she only wanted to make sure I was not an Indian, the interview passed off successfully, and 2 weeks later, Terry moved in. From the middle of November, therefore, I had nearby a place of retreat. I had only to walk a little way up Haverstock Hill, turn left into Belsize Avenue, and then, having continued along it for a few hundred yards in the direction of Swiss Cottage, turn left again into Lancaster Grove. As I did so, the noise of the traffic would gradually die away, then cease altogether, and when, 15 minutes after leaving the Vihara, I entered Mrs. Hartman's domain, it would be to find myself enveloped in a profound silence, a silence I could guarantee would be broken over the next few hours only by the occasional flushing of a distant toilet. While Terry was still working, I tended to make use of the flat only at weekends and late in the evening, sometimes staying there overnight when I had a lecture to think about the following morning. Since we were free from interruptions, we took no telephone calls and received no visitors. Our discussions could last as long and go as deep as we pleased, without the necessity of our going away for the weekend in the little bus. It was at this time, I think, that the subject of energy first arose and was discussed at great length between us. How it arose, I no longer recollect. Probably it was in connection with the sexo-yogic practices of the Vajrayana, as described to me in Kalimpong by Yogi Chen, or Wilhelm Reich's highly controversial ideas about energy, character armor, and orgasm, or what is most likely in connection with both. Terry was particularly interested in the relation between sexual energy and spiritual energy, especially so far as this had a bearing on the practice of celibacy. Fond as he was of Vivian, he was finding the sexual side of their relationship increasingly repugnant. Her orgasms, so he told me, were becoming more and more primitive, and when they had intercourse, he felt as though a fine thread was being drawn from his brain. Whether he ever communicated his repugnance to Vivian, I do not know, but it was she who, in effect, solved the problem around this time by embarking on a Freudian analysis, one of the requirements of which was that she should abstain from sexual activity while it was in progress. As Terry was not interested in finding a new girlfriend, this meant a period of abstinence for him too, and he in fact remained celibate for the next 2 years or more. But although not interested in finding a new girlfriend, he was certainly interested in finding a Dakini. A Dakini, in Tantric tradition, is a woman or a goddess who, as the embodiment of a current of spiritual energy, has the effect of arousing the dormant energies of the practitioner by whom she is taken, in fact or symbolically, meditation. Terry had first heard about Dakinis from me when I told him, quite early in our friendship, about Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, perhaps the most eminent of my Tibetan teachers, whose own Dakini and chief disciple was a young woman remarkable alike for her beauty, her intelligence, and her devotion. At the time, he showed little interest in the subject, and in our discussions on energy, it was touched on only incidentally. But during the months that followed the ending of his sexual relationship with Vivian, he became increasingly interested, not just in Dakinis in general, but in the idea of finding that unique, magical person who, by being his Dakini, would grant him the kind of ideal fulfillment he had expected to find in marriage. It was an idea that eventually came to preoccupy him virtually to the point of obsession, and which, in the end, proved to be no more than a will-o'-the-wisp, leading him deeper into the morass of disappointment, frustration, and despair. That development was then many months away. Meanwhile, not all our time together at the flat was spent in discussion. Terry had a record player, and sometimes we listened to music last thing at night. Our favourites were Mozart, Chopin, and Grieg, especially the piano concertos of all three composers, and in my case at least, Haydn and the Elgar of the Enigma Variations. As a teenager, I had been passionately fond of music, and had listened to symphony concerts on the radio whenever I had the opportunity. For me, music was not the brandy of the damned, but the ambrosia of the blessed, and swept me up to heights of ecstasy in a way that even poetry could not do. In India, I was rarely able to listen to music, that is, Western classical music. Such music was not easy to come by, and in any case, as a Theravadin Buddhist monk, I was expected to observe the rule of abstaining from, quote, dance, song, instrumental music, and improper shows. This rule I had long understood as applying only to music of the cruder and more vulgar kind, such as must have been no less popular in the Buddha's day than it is in our own, and I was therefore able to listen to Mozart and the rest of my and Terry's favourites with a clear conscience. The School of Economic Science, which Terry had recently left, indeed regarded the music of Mozart in particular as having a positive, spiritualising effect on the mind. What the school thought of Wagner, I do not know. The composer was by no means a favourite of mine, though as a teenager I had enjoyed the overtures to Lohengrin and Tannhauser. But when a member of the Sangha Association offered that autumn to take me to see all four constituent parts of the Ring Cycle at Covent Garden, I was glad to accept. Wendy was a tall, angular woman of 30 or thereabouts who worked at Coutts Bank in the Strand and was a keen practitioner of judo. Her angularity was not only physical but mental. There were all sorts of sharp corners and edges to her personality. And while she could be warm-hearted and generous, as her offer to me demonstrated, she was morbidly quick to take offence, and was, in truth, of so prickly, indeed so spiky a disposition, and so extremely sharp-tongued, that I called her, to her great amusement and delight, Kuta Danta, or Sharp Tooth, after an old Brahmin mentioned in the Pali scriptures. Had I then been as familiar with modern psychology and its jargon as I afterwards became, I would probably have said that Wendy Kuta Danta found it difficult to accept herself as a woman. In India, the women had appeared to experience no such difficulty. She certainly resented being treated as a woman, and the fact that I accepted her offer to take me to see the ring cycle pleased her immensely. For since monks were not supposed to go out and about with women, my acceptance meant I was not treating her as a mere woman, but as a man. So pleased was she that she dressed for our opera going in a striking Chinese-style outfit of yellow satin, heavily embroidered, which, besides giving her a distinctly oriental look, made her appear much more feminine. I, of course, had on, over my robes, the long fawn-coloured cloak I always wore outside the vihara. We must have been an odd-looking pair. The first time we made our way to the Royal Opera House through Covent Garden Market, one of the porters called out to his companion with true Cockney wit, "Look, mate, here comes Julius Caesar and Cleopatra." Neither of us could help laughing, and Wendy, strange to relate, seemed not at all displeased to think she looked like the Royal Egyptian femme fatale. As for me, for a moment, it was as though Caesar's laurel wreath encircled my brow. An incident that occurred on our way back from Covent Garden one night was definitely not a laughing matter at the time. I do not remember which part of the cycle we had just seen, but whichever one it was, so overwhelmed was I by the experience that during our journey back to Belsize Park, I sat speechless, unable to utter a word. Unfortunately, Kuta Danta completely misunderstood my silence. She thought I was silent because I was angry with her, and that I was angry because I had not enjoyed the performance, and blamed her for being responsible for my having wasted a whole evening. This was enough to throw her into a state of emotional turmoil in which she blamed herself for taking me to the opera, blamed me for allowing myself to be taken, hated me for being angry with her, and hated herself for hating me. The misunderstanding was cleared up only some days later, when, having recovered the use of my tongue, I thanked her warmly for giving me the opportunity of seeing the complete ring cycle, and assured her that I had thoroughly enjoyed the whole experience. Towards the end of November, when Terry had been settled in the new flat for less than a fortnight, we spent 2 days in Cambridge. The reason for the visit was that the University Buddhist Society had invited me to speak on the topic of practical problems of the European Buddhist, problems with which I was beginning to be well acquainted. The lecture was to have been given by Marco Pallas. The subject was of his own choosing. But as he was ill, I was asked, at short notice, to take his place, even though I had addressed the Society only a few weeks earlier on the topic of the spiritual community in Buddhism. On our arrival in the city, we met John Hipkin for lunch, and at his suggestion went to see the Russian Hamlet at the local arts cinema. Both Terry and I enjoyed this black-and-white version of the famous play, and though 34 years have passed since I saw the film, the appearance of the murdered king's ghost on the castle battlements amid swirling mist remains a vivid memory. It was also at John's suggestion, indeed on his warm recommendation, that we saw Peter Brook's production of Peter Weiss's controversial Marat stroke Sad at the Aldwych. Neither of us enjoyed it very much, though not because it could be regarded from a strict Theravadin point of view as being an improper show. Improper or not, I was in any case beginning to be less rigid in my observance of the rules relating to such matters as taking solid food after midday, listening to music, and wearing robes, at least when I was at the flat with Terry.